reading from the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. Chapter 3, text 53. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sadanasu cha yogita manasaha. Additionally, the mind becomes fit for concentration. So we're now in the section of Yoga Sutras. The second section is called practice because, mentioned before, yoga, which really refers to meditative absorption, requires a high degree of sattva or goodness for one's meditation to enact the level of transformation, yoga chitta vidyoga, the level of transformation that's actually yoga, to really get benefit from yoga as a transformatory process, there has to be a certain adhikarya qualification to be able to meditate, which requires goodness. So, therefore, chapter 2 is the practice to come there. And the practice to come to the level of meditative absorption has been described in two ways. One is Kriya Yoga, a threefold process of austerity, study, and sacrifice your dedication of submission to God. And an overlapping process, or another way to describe it in a more elaborate way, is Ashtanga Yoga, an eightfold process, which also gradually brings you to the point of meditation, Dharana, Dhyan, Samadhi. And in the next chapter, it's going to describe that when one comes to that level of meditation, the real transformation of the mind substantially takes place. I forgot what that was called, but those three together, they happen together. It's not you just go to samadhi. It kind of your meditation just deepens in a way, focusing on a particular thing, and it really sets into stage a dynamic. So now we've been still, Patanjali has been describing the Ashtanga Yoga process. So yam and niyam has been elaborately described. Moral restraints, the control of the mind in terms of how you're dealing with others, then moral observances, the control of the mind in terms of how you deal with yourself. It's a progression. You must begin with restraint. If you're going to be a yogi, you must begin with restraint in terms of how you deal with others. And if you don't, you can't go to the other process. And one practice leads to another. One practice leads to another. Otherwise, you really can't get to meditation. Maybe someone could start with asana and experience some type of goodness transformation, but without moral restraint, without nonviolence and the other core truthfulness and the other core moral restraints, you really can't go into the process of meditation because negative thoughts or conceptions against moral restraints and moral observances, negative thoughts, are so antithetical to stopping the mind. In fact, they accelerate the vrittis or the transformations of the mind according to passion and ignorance. They accelerate it. The negative thoughts means thoughts against moral restraints, thoughts against moral observances. You have to counteract these. So asana may help you then to come to yam and niyam, but asana alone without yam and niyam cannot lead to pratyahara, which is a complete abnegation of the senses. But that has to begin at the platform of the mind. The mind has to be restrained. And first it has to be restrained in terms of your dealings with others. Yes. In fact, unless one works on ahimsa, nothing else can proceed in yoga. Because if you're aggressive, violent, either physically or mentally exploitive person, what is the question of controlling the mind? So we've discussed yam niyam, and I can't. And a beautiful point in terms of niyam, moral observances, it's your submission to God. When the analysis comes down to it, it's the only meditational prop it's the only object of meditation which is not just a prop, but which intervenes, responds to your desire to control the mind. Okay, and then just basically coming then, asana was described, of course, it's not the goal, meditation is, but when you're on the platform of Gyan, cultivation of distinction between the soul and the body, meditation is only possible when there is asana. And asana means when you can sit firmly and comfortably. Firmly means you sit up straight. Comfortably means it's not a strain. Because if it's a strain, then you'll be in bodily consciousness. And the whole purpose of asana is so that you're not thinking of the body. So initially there may be strain, but to really use asana as a benefit for meditation, you have to come to the point where it's the posture is obtained by a relaxation of effort and an absorption in the divine. Because without that absorption in the divine, it's hard also to transcend the body. But the purpose of the asana is you're not affected by duality, because the body is always affected by duality, isn't it? It's sometimes hot, it's sometimes cold, it's sometimes tired, it's sometimes active. So when one perfects asana, then meditation is possible. But of course, on the bhakti path, when one develops attraction, then one may not even need asana. And the example of the Bhagavatam is Sishupal. He hated Krishna since birth, but because it was such an emotional absorption, he was completely focused on Krishna. And one who has that spontaneous attachment, his meditation goes on regardless of the condition of the body. The meditation goes on even at the stage of death. And I know bhakti meditators. I have a friend, extremely ill, extremely painful condition of the body, some nerve problems in his face, extreme pain, kind of like having an impacted wisdom tooth, but not taking morphine, extreme pain. But the meditation on Krishna could not stop. But anyway, that was describing asana. It comfortably, relax, firm, and you don't think of the body. And then it's a tremendous support for meditation. And if we are not on the spontaneous platform, or I don't know if everyone is in bhakti path, anyway, that's it. A lot of people download this too. You also have to, in your meditation, live in a way so you're not disturbed from the body. Otherwise, it's going to be difficult to focus on the holy name. So I know Prabhupada, when he saw that, I was in Vrindavan in 76, Pradyumna was there, Prabhupada was there, and Pradyumna told me that Prabhupada was upset, he was so weak. Prabhupada got down and I think wanted to show him how to do a push-up. You know, so that the body is healthy and you're not so affected by dualities before you come to a platform of spontaneous attraction. Just a side point, which is why kirtan is so recommended for absorption in meditation, because the nature of kirtan is because the object of meditation is absorbing all the senses. So even if the mind is not controlled and goes to the senses, it still doesn't sway from the object of meditation. And therefore, in the process of kirtan, and bhakti in general, because you can be in an engaging shastra vichar, studying the scriptures from different angles, discussing things in a way. There can be a level of absorption, a deep level of absorption beyond one's level of purification purely within the modes. We see this in kirtan. You can become absorbed for hours and hours and hours. So that's just a side point, that level of absorption. Then the process is progressive. You know, without asana, it's hard to take the pranayama, which is a suspension of breath, which helps to control the mind, and it does control the mind. It's useless unless the mind is subdued. It must be for the suspension of the mind. And he describes the stages of this type of pranayama: external, internal, and restrained. External means after breathing out, the breath is stopped, focusing the mind. Internal, after breathing in, the breath is stopped and the mind is subdued and restrained. The breath is going on internally, basically. And it becomes, pranayama by the number of breaths, by the distance of breath, how powerful the breath is, that means. And a distance and the time, how long one holds the breath. There's different types of pranayama, but it's very effective for subduing the mind. And then there's a fourth type, which is kind of like the third type of restrained, but while restrained is like a single effort, the fourth type is a prolonged effort. And one great yogis and the commentaries here of Professor Brian's book, when he describes the commentaries of the prolonged effort, there are documented evidence of yogis who, even in the modern times, who restrain the breath for weeks or days. What to speak of historical shastric stories of that, like Dhruva Maharaj, whose stepmother, who was not his mother, father had two wives, So the stepmother, who was the favorite wife, wouldn't let him, because he wasn't her son, sit on the lap of his father, the king. And he became so, as a warrior, became so incensed. He says, I want a planet greater than this. I want a king. He was so incensed. And then what happened is his mother encouraged him to seek out God. And through Guru, he got a process of meditation and pranayama to do. And it was so powerful. It's one of his level of meditation, and his breath restraint is so powerful. There's a certain there's a certain meditation where you take on the qualities of the object of your meditation. He was meditating on Vishnu. His consciousness was expanding in such a way that when he was holding his breath, the universe was suffocating. So there's historical examples. But the result of that type of meditation is that the covering of illumination is weakened. Illumination means what? Sattva. Yoga means to bring the mind to sattva. It's like an instrument in its perfected state. It's like an instrument of perception in its perfected state. If it's a mirror, the perfected state is lucidity, and it's clean, it's straight, becomes perfectly reflective. Or a magnifying glass or a microscope or binoculars. It has a certain power in its pure state that if the lens is scratched, if the lens is distorted, then its power of perception is also checked or distorted. So the mind is like that. The mind, sattva means the original state of being. So when the mind comes to the original state of being, the original utility or purpose, that's called yoga. And from perception, you can see things clearly, including your soul and your body is different from the soul. And then you can imbibe in the pure nature. That's yoga. So the covering of this illumination, which means the modes of passion and ignorance, which are distracting the consciousness, covering the consciousness. When you do this, it says when you do this pranayama, the covering is weakened. Because it says the prakash, the illumination, what is it? Illumination is the symptom of goodness. We all experience that. If we wake up early in the morning and we slept in goodness and we're in a place of goodness, like the country, and we wake up in the morning, which is a time of goodness, and the mind has an illuminating effect. All of a sudden we can smell things better. We can see things better. When we look at a page and we study, the clarity is manyfold increased because there's light coming through the senses. All the senses become just, it's like a room is dark. You can't make out things. You may not be able to read something. There's not enough light. And then if the light comes, everything becomes clear. So the senses are able to perceive things clearly, but not in a sensual way, but in a way that they're actually able to distinguish things for what they are and be able to see things clearly. So that covering illumination is weakened. One second in here, I just got to do one thing. So that covering is actually karma. The actions that we have done away from the pure nature of soul that create impressions which trigger behavioral patterns, preconditioned attitudes, perspectives, responses to the world, such as immoral deeds. I'm reading now because this is good. It is a net of illusion because, like a net with many knots, when the myriad samskara is fructified, they channel awareness away from its source. That's when the mind is distorted, then it channels awareness away from its source. When there's samskaras and the karma born of that, it channels awareness away from its source. Awareness, you don't see yourself. Rather, you see that which is temporary, and unreal. You see that as the self. Very nice. So good point, so important, like a mantra, channels awareness away from its source and absorbs it in conditioned patterns of behavior. And then it means the sattva of the mind forgets the true nature of the soul and becomes enamored by the objects of the senses, says Vigyan Bhakti. Pursuing these sense objects, additional karma is produced, and thus the mind remains further trapped and entangled in this net of action and reaction. In this sense, it is karma that sustains ignorance, the covering of knowledge, the misconceptions of body and self, senses of the true self. So this misconception, which is the basis of not yoga, the basis of entanglement, rather than yoga or awareness, this is destroyed, weakened substantially by pranayama, which supports meditation. Although technically only knowledge can ultimately destroy ignorance, says Hariharananda, it is only when the covering of karma is weakened that knowledge can shine forth unobstructed. This covering of karma is weakened, said Vyas, by the practice of pranayama. Since I've been reading these verses just to help me in my own personal meditation of chanting Maha Mantra, I chant one mantra silently, and I chant one mantra, deep breath, chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Then I hold the breath and chant four mantras, and then exhale, chanting two mantras. Just because I read it here, that's one of the... Actually, I was speaking to Janava, she's listening today, who teaches pranayama. She said that's a renunciate meditation. That you can meditate, you know, one breath in, hold one breath, you know, equal in, restrain, equal out, restrain. But I did found it very, you know, after this inspiration here, I found it very effective. And then I continued chanting, you know, out loud, hearing the mantra, but with the mind as a sharper instrument for perception of the mantra, for hearing of the mantra, for thinking of the mantra, for feeling the qualities of the mantra, the mind becomes a sharper instrument. So I found that effective. He quotes a verse that there is no greater ascetic practice than pranayama from which the effects are purified and the light of knowledge shines forth. Manu too states that from the performance of pranayama accompanied by the repetition of the Om mantra, quote, the impurities of the sensory powers are burnt away, just as the defiling impurities of metal ore are burnt away in the heat of the furnace. People listening to this are meditators to one degree or another. And one time you chant your mantra, but where is it? You can't hear it. You can't see it. Because the instrument of the mind is so distorted. So here it's recommending to help with that. It's a mechanical method. But it's a mechanical method to sharpen the instrument of perception, which can be used in meditating on mantra with devotion. Now we'll read the purport for today's verse. Additionally, the mind becomes fit for concentration. Manasa is used here rather than chitta, as it is the specific aspect of the chitta that interacts with the senses. And awareness must now make a transition from the sensory involvements of pranayama and the next limb, pratyahara, to the transsensory stage of dharana, concentration. So anyway, manasa, the mind becomes fit for concentration because, anyway, there's three aspects to the mind. There's the ahankara, the self-conception one has. There's the manas, which is how one categorizes and feels about things. And there's the buddhi, how one judges things. So it's the manas which categorizes things and ascribes things. So the manas, that's the aspect of the mind, or the chitta, we can call it the chitta, of the mind or the chitta, how it interacts with the world. So the mind, it becomes fit for concentration because it can abstract itself. Once one does pranayama, the mind is able to extract itself from the senses. So generally, it's being dragged or pulled by the senses. And then, when the mind becomes fit for concentration, then the mind can be fully extracted from the senses, and that's called pratyahara. And then when the mind is fully extracted from the senses, then you can do dharana or real concentration. Dharana is the sixth level of yoga, which will be discussed shortly. The commentators assume this sutra to be self-explanatory and have little to add. For the mind to be able to fix on an object of concentration, it must be sattvic. That is, rajas and tamas must be minimized. Bhojaraj says that once freed from its defects by these breathing techniques, the mind can remain fixed wherever it is directed. In other words, the correct performance of pranayama prepares the mind for concentration, the preliminary stage of meditation and ultimate samadhi. So pranayama is a preparatory stage for preliminary stages of meditation and ultimately the goal, which is samadhi. Again, the sequential nature of the limbs is indicated in this sutra. You have to go yam, niyam, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, then dharana. You want to meditate, you have to be able to withdraw the mind from the senses, pratyahara. But one more step is required for the mind before the mind can successfully undertake the practice of dharana concentration. This is the fifth line. So before dharana or concentration, the senses have to be withdrawn, the mind has to be withdrawn from the senses, and therefore the next verse discusses the fifth stage, which is pratyahara. Pratyahara, withdrawal from sense objects, occurs when the senses do not come into contact with their respective sense objects. It corresponds, as it were, to the nature of the mind. So, basically what this is saying, before meditation, you have to withdraw the senses, the mind from the sense objects, this pratyahara. And when that happens, it occurs, then the senses do not come in contact with the sense objects. You withdraw the mind from the senses, and then the senses become weakened. The mind is not withdrawn from the senses, then the senses will not contact the sense objects. So this is accomplished through the mind, he says. When the mind is under control, Vyas, the senses are automatically under control. They do not need to be restrained separately. So once the mind can be controlled and fixed in concentration, then you don't need to control the senses. The senses are automatically controlled. And that's like, they give the example sometimes in the Upanishads as the body being the chariot and the soul being the passenger, the driver being the intelligence, the reins being the mind, and the horses being the senses. So if the mind is controlled by the intelligence, then the senses are controlled. And the senses are controlled means the senses are withdrawn from the sense objects. So this is Pratyahara. And Vyas gives a metaphor from the Prashna Upanishads. Just as when the queen bee flies up, all the other bees flying up along with her. And when the queen bee settles down, all the other bees automatically settle down. So the mind and senses are directly interconnected. When the mind is fixed on the object of meditation, says Vijnana Bhikshu, the senses cease their functioning without any separate endeavor. When the mind is not controlled, it becomes inclined to follow the senses and is dragged out into the sensual world. So, the mind is controlled by meditation. So when you, it's such a nice progression. From pranayama, the mind becomes fit for concentration. When the mind becomes fit for concentration, then the mind is controlled. When the mind is controlled, the senses are controlled. When the senses are controlled, they're restrained from the sense objects. And when you come to that level, then you could really begin meditation. You can begin the type of meditation that subdues the buddhis and sets this powerful transformatory dynamic into place. And then he quotes Manu, if one of the senses slips away, a person's knowledge slips away through that sense, like water from a water bed. So even one sense, then you're external, without control. Because, you know, of course, bhakti is different. We'll see how that is. So, but yoga means complete renunciation. And also the Gita state, the senses are so impetuous. The senses are so impetuous that even one of the senses that goes astray even one of the senses that goes astray carries the mind away of even a learned person who is endeavoring to control them. So even a man of discrimination, the sense is so impetuous that one sense, contacting a sense, that can carry away the man of discrimination. And now the last verse in this section, and from this, Pratyahara, from this comes the highest control of the senses. So the highest control of the senses in the yoga path is Pratyahara, when the mind is completely withdrawn from the senses. Parama, in relationship to Vatsyata in the Anam. Sita Parama, Vasyatendriyanam, from this, Pratyahara, comes the Parama Vasyata control of the interim, the senses. So from this, he's saying in yoga, this is the highest. And then Vyas gives, he says, some say that sense control means enjoying sense objects as long as they're not prohibited. Others say that sense control means contact with the sense objects according to one's desires, rather than according to the dictates of the sense. And still others, that sense control involves engaging with sense objects without attachment or aversion happening. Real sense control, however, Vyas, reiterating the previous verse, is when pratyahara, when the mind is restrained and focused because the senses are automatically brought into control. And for a yogi, Vyas gives the opinion of the vachaspati of is that if they're still involved with contact with the senses, then there's always the danger of being overcome with them. Therefore, the highest control is no engagement. But it's interesting, in the commentary, it's going to describe how difficult this is, and then it's going to give the example of devotion and how when one has devotion for God, then really one gets the highest sense control. I'll read it because it's very interesting. Not read it, but there's a story. Many of you know Sobari Muni, and he, in an attempt to not be allured to the senses and distraction, he practiced austerity under the water. But then under the water, it's great for meditation, because there's no distraction to the senses, and you can achieve a very high level of meditation under the water. Problem is, it's holding your breath. But when you're at the fourth stage of pranayama, you can suppress your breath for as long as you want and survive peacefully in environments that are normally inhospitable. But even in this most removed environment, the sage's mind was not under control, and he became distracted by a pair of fish mating. Witnessing this act, the sage became overwhelmed with sensual desires, abandoned his asceticism, and turned his attention to conjugal indulgence. So Professor Blank gives a nice analysis according to yoga psychology. Although the sage had mastered great lofty attainments in terms of pranayama, his chitta nonetheless contained unlimited samskaras from previous lives, including samskaras of previous sexual experiences. By meditating underwater, the sage had tried to remove himself from any possible temptation that might awaken these, but these dormant sexual samskaras were nonetheless activated by the slightest external sexual stimulus, in this case, mating fish. Again, Bhikshu introduced a theistic element here by quoting the Gita. The senses are so agitating, O Arjuna, that they forcibly carry away the mind, even if a person is struggling to control them. But a person restrains all of them and remains with mind fixed on me, Krishna as the supreme, with senses under control, has steady knowledge. The Gita is recommending something higher. Ramananda Saraswati, the commentators are theistic, mostly because they follow Vyas, who's theistic, who follows Patanjali, although it's not a theistic text, and therefore he neutrally deals with the control of the mind, even to the extent of mentioning Ishvara as an optional object of meditation, because he's talking about a mechanical process of what happens when one focuses on one object, what happens to the rest of the impressions in the consciousness, and how they become subdued. So he's neutral, but his bent is theistic. So generally, the commentators who follow him are theistic. To give the example of Sita, who had mastered the highest sense control. Sita's mind was so fixed on her husband, Ram, that even though abducted and in captivity, she was immune to all the lures of the powerful demon Ramana, who was trying to seduce her. Here we see that in the more Ishvara-focused theologies of the theistic traditions, rather than trying to suppress all one's past samskaras exclusively by one's own will and meditative prowess, and not run the risk of past samskaras reacting, as was the case with the sage Subari, the yogi instead saturates the mind with devotional samskaras related to thoughts directed to the divine form and activities of God Ishvara. This is a more theologically elaborate expansion of Patanjali's Ishvara Pranidhan, based on the idea that rather than exclusively suppressing negative mundane samskaras, one strives to replace them with transcendent ones, a theistic variant of the Pratipaksha Bhavana from 11.233. Let me just go back and see what 233 is. Now I remember what it is. Okay. Yeah. Upon being harassed by negative thoughts, one should cultivate counteracting thoughts. So this is a theistic variance of programming the mind. Because it mentioned, if you have negative thoughts, something against one of the niyams. So let's say there's sex desire, so you're attracted to it, so you counteract it by thoughts of what happens when one indulges in that without restraint. You want to be a yogi, now you're entangled in material life. You want to be a yogi, but if you engage in sex life, you'll lose your determination, you'll lose your vira, you'll lose your power. You know, so you counteracted by a counteracting thought. But this is theistic. The counteracting thought to the impulses that one feels is devotional impulses. Of the impulse to surrender and submit and love God fully. And when those samskaras are powerful in the consciousness, then one's not just by his will suppressing the senses, but one has no desire to engage the senses in a Krishna activities that are tormenting and bring it away from the soul. Why don't we just, I finished the chat. Hey, pretty good. Let's see, we finished 300 pages. Those have been studying, we've accomplished a lot. 300 pages out of 470 pages. And I'm going to go into the next chapter, but if it's not relevant so much, I'll just ask you to read the rest of the book. Relevant means, I don't know, if it's just going to list, it says mystic powers, what mystic power, I'll just see how we proceed. But I'm definitely going to go into the next chapter, and then I'll feel it out, whether or not I have a feeling, definitely before this summer's out, we'll have to have a new topic for our Wednesday a Wednesday class. I'm thinking of maybe a summary of the Bhagavad Gita, but from the standpoint of psychology. Look at the Bhagavad Gita at different levels, how it transforms the mind. Here's the chapter summary. So let's see, those of you who it's a pretty regular group that has been listening. Let's see how it works here. The chapter begins with an introduction of Kriya Yoga, verse 1, its effects, verse 2, and a discussion of the kleshas, which it removes, 3 to 11. Karma and its consequences are outlined, 12 to 14, and the principle of suffering established, 15 to 16. This is followed by the characteristics of the seer and the seen, 17 to 22. The conjunction between them, 23 and 24, and the definition of liberation, 25 to 27. Next, the eight limbs of yoga are introduced as the means to attain liberation, 28 to 29. and the remainder of the chapter is dedicated to the yams and their universality, 30 to 31, the niyams, 32, the means to counter tendencies contrary to the yams and niyams, 33 to 34, and the side benefits accrued from observing them, 35 to 45, next asana, the third limb is presented, 46 to 48, followed by pranayama, the fourth limb, and 49 to 53, and pratyahara, the fifth. So, very important section coming up in the third chapter, which is dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, and then the mystic powers that accrue by focusing that meditation on different parts of the body. Are there any questions? Okay. Would anyone like to say hello? Hello? Who's that?
Hare Krishna?
Gail?
Yeah.
Is that Gail?
Yeah. Yes.
You don't know how much I appreciate that every class you listen. Because without listeners, I can't speak. Thank you.
I did have...
I don't know if I appreciate your questions as much, but anyway, I'm just joking. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you were talking about ahimsa and how you cannot meditate if, moral, especially nonviolence is not in place. I was thinking of people who appear to be basically in the mode of goodness,
Okay.
I'm thinking of people who are basically seem to be in the mode of goodness. You know, they're very calm, gentle people,
Yeah.
But they are meat eaters.
They are what?
Yeah. Meat eaters.
Meat eaters.
Like, for example, Mother Teresa, right?
Yeah.
I think she was probably a meat eater. So, but she was a very calm and, gentle person, And so it's difficult to imagine that, certain people would not be able to...
Well, I still think it's compromised, but I would have to say probably there's a little bit difference in that type of thing, which is kind of done in complete ignorance.
Mm.
You understand what I'm saying? It's done in complete ignorance. And it is violent, but somehow other people don't associate it with violence. It's even like in the modern world, if you drink milk, it's really connected to a lot of violence, in one sense. It depends what kind of milk, but the factory milk and things like that. But it's the more you become aware of things, the more you become implicated in them, and the more it affects your consciousness. So I would say it definitely has an effect. It definitely has an effect. Definitely. Because, even if you're not necessarily aware, it still has an effect on the consciousness. But it appears not to have the same effect on the consciousness when you're not aware of it. That's all I would say. You're not aware of their violence. It's just ignorance. It's not directly aggression in one sense, in their consciousness or something like that. But I would doubt the level of meditation they can attain, actually. If you're talking about yoga, to actually sit down, this is yoga, to actually sit down and, because even in the bhakti it says, aho bhatat swapachato gariyan yajiva grevartate nama tubyam tefas. It says that even if someone, aho bhatat swapachato gariyan, oh how wonderful it is, aho bhatat swapachato gariyan, how wonderful it is that if one just chants the mantra once, right, that one has already performed, even if he's a dog eater, even if he's already bathed in all rivers, already performed all sacrifices, etc. And Jiva Goswami says, Swapacho, it's actually a dog eater. That's the cultural context one is in. You know, so there's a certain ignorance to it, and it doesn't have as much effect. It's your cultural context, you know. So it somehow or other is the feelings of exploitation are not there, even though the result of exploitation is not there. So it appears, even that verse says that, you know, in that kind of cultural context, it's not held exactly the same way against you in terms of your consciousness. But at the same time, still one's limited.
Mhm. Okay. Thank you.
Gail, you ask. I love your questions. You get right to the point. Ooh. Okay. I have to be sharp, you know. I got Mooney there on Sunday. You know, you're in the audience. Good. Thank you. Anybody else like to say hello or ask a question? So nice to see people out there.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Govardhan.
Hare Krishna, Govardhan. Thank you.
Okay.
Nice to see you and your family on Saturday. Very nice. We'll get back to you about coming down there sometime. Okay, thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? One more person. Okay, we'll end for today. Thank you all. Bunch of hope for the discharge of the Hindu, the child, for people in poverty.